isn't this moment what matters the most? And honey, isn't this moment what matters the most?
Welcome to This Hour Has 50 Minutes, where two therapists talk more than they listen. I'm your host, Dr. Tamara Souls. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 25 of This Hour Has 50 Minutes. I am your host, Dr. Tamara Souls, and I'm excited to bring you this episode today with Dr. Miriam Kirmayr, where we're talking about adult friendships. Before we get into more of Miriam's amazing work, I want to take a moment to acknowledge that this podcast is now 1 year old. Yes, this episode is the 1 year anniversary of This Hour Has 50 Minutes. And I have loved every single episode and every conversation that I've been privileged to have. I would love to continue to have these thought-provoking conversations that move conversations about mental health forward and not only enrich the lives of clinicians and myself, but also the general public who is hearing more and more about what therapeutic services can look like, which serves to destigmatize mental health and make mental health more accessible to everybody else. I've put a lot of thought into how best to continue this podcast. I truly would like to keep this podcast ad-free so I can always be sure that the content I'm providing is solely for the purpose of enriching our clinical lives and our understanding of mental health. If you would like to help me continue to create meaningful therapeutic content, then consider supporting the podcast through the site buymeacoffee.com/thishour. Supporting the podcast in this way allows you to align your money with your values and support the work you believe in. You can choose to support the podcast with a $5 monthly or an annual investment of $50. But one of the great things about Buy Me a Coffee is that you can also do a single contribution. So if you listen to an episode and find it helpful or meaningful to you, please make a one-time contribution. You can do this one-time contribution or become a mental health champion monthly by going to buymeacoffee.com/thishour. The link is also in the show notes. Now, back to my interview with the always wise Dr. Miriam Kirmayr. Dr. Miriam Kirmayr is a clinical psychologist and leading friendship expert who has studied the science of friendship and social connection for over a decade. Her work focuses on helping others navigate life transitions, cultivate resilience and self-compassion, and build stronger relationships. Miriam has been featured in outlets like The Atlantic, CNN, Forbes, The New York Times, Time, and Vogue, and she's a featured expert for Psychology Today and Women's Health, and a guest on shows like The Today Show and NPR. Miriam lives in Montreal with her husband and her sweet, curious, and spirited son, Liam. And she's currently working on her first nonfiction book on adult friendships. I had the great pleasure of supervising Miriam for some of her graduate practicum work, and she is just an incredible clinician and overall human being. And I was delighted to talk to her today about friendships in adulthood. We talk about the benefits of friendship and the health risks associated with isolation and loneliness. We talk about ways to make friends as an adult and connect with friends during the pandemic. Miriam also shares some important ways that we can support friends through very challenging times that arise in many of our adult lives. And finally, we explore the idea of friendship therapy and what it means to have two friends in therapy together. Let's get started.
This was such a long-awaited conversation, and I am so happy to finally have it with you and share my love of you with the audience. So why don't we dive in with you describing, Miriam, a little bit more about yourself and the work that you do.
Yeah, well, I'm so happy that we made this work. It really has been a long time coming, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. So I am a clinical psychologist. I'm also based in Montreal, which is where we connected initially. Yeah. And my clinical practice really focuses on relationship difficulties kind of across the board. So I work with families, with couples, and I also work with friends. So I think that's the piece that we're really going to focus on today is my work on friendship. So in addition to the clinical piece, from a research perspective, I've studied the science of friendship for the last decade or so, really looking to answer questions about how we make friends, how we maintain our friendships, how we navigate the different challenges that come up in these relationships, betrayals, missteps, conflicts, and also how we cope with the loss of friendship. So answering some of those questions empirically and then really working to share those answers and that information publicly. So that's where some of my writing comes in, my media work and speaking work, and conversations like this.
I love it because there's such a gap in the literature too, but certainly in the public discourse about adult friendships and young adult friendships, despite the fact that there is so much need there. So what led to you focusing on adult friendships and young adult friendships in particular?
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, that gap that you're describing, there's also, you know, obviously a personal connection to this, seeing how my own friendships have shifted and evolved over the years.
Of course.
Whether that's starting graduate school, becoming a mother, you know, different transitions in life, our relationships can shift. And I always found that really interesting and difficult and meaningful even. So that was certainly a part of it. But on the kind of research end of things, I was really noticing that there is this huge gap in terms of answering these questions scientifically. And that's in very stark contrast to what we see with kids, where both on the research end of things and clinically, and so much of the important work that you do with families too, right, is about helping children to build close, healthy relationships of all kinds. And peer relationships definitely fit under that umbrella. There's such an explicit emphasis on helping kids to develop social skills and collaborate and cooperate, and the emphasis we place on extracurriculars, right? And that just isn't there for adults, for young adults.
Right.
There's this expectation that we should just have it figured out. We should just know what to do by then, that this isn't challenging. This isn't inherently a, you know, a problem or a human struggle that so many of us are facing. And yet so many of us are going through this. And so seeing that disconnect, that discrepancy was really, you know, what I needed to see to step into this place of wanting to hopefully make a bit of a difference in that.
Absolutely. State. Absolutely. I think there are some obvious advantages to having a friendship network as an adult. But aside from the obvious, you know, supports that come from friendships, what are some of the research say about the benefits of friendship beyond just social support?
Yeah, I mean, yes, having a close circle of friends feels good, right? Intuitively, I don't think this is going to be a hard sell for anyone who's listening here today. But the research is very clear that firstly, social connection, as you know, as a broader term or experience, is so important for our mental health, for our physical health and well-being. But then when we look at friendship specifically, we see that that plays a unique role in some of those outcomes. And depending on who we are, where we are in our lives, our age, friendships can actually become even more important than our other types of relationships, our family connections, our partnerships. And so what we see, for example, is that having close, stable friendships leads to better mental health outcomes like anxiety and depression. It reduces our risk or helps us to cope if we're already struggling. It improves our mood, so boosts our happiness and life satisfaction. Physical health perspective reduces our risk for chronic health conditions. And it really does actually increase our lifespan. We're much more likely to live longer and healthier lives when we feel connected to our friends. And then there's this whole other interesting area that's emerging now, looking at success in the workplace, which I also think is worth mentioning because people often see it as, you know, an either or. Either I invest in my career or I invest in my relationships and some of these kind of, you know, softer life skills and experiences. And what we're seeing is that those two are very, very complementary.
Oh, that is intriguing. We could go off on a whole thing there. That's so fascinating. So the flip side then, what does research tell us about the risks of a lack of that social network or a lack of friendships or social support?
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about because, you know, having friends add something to our lives and not having those friends or not having those close trusting connections, there are very real consequences. It's not just about reaping those benefits that we can absolutely suffer and struggle in very significant ways. So we are more likely, for example, to experience different health conditions. There's this stat that came out in a research study not too long ago that got a lot of buzz, understandably, which was showing that feeling lonely is akin to smoking, I think it was 15 cigarettes a day, in terms of the effects that has on
our health.
Right. And every time we hear that, I mean, it's kind of shocking, but it just goes to show, you know, what social creatures we really are and how in many ways feeling connected to our friends, to our communities, it really, I mean, I'm biased here, obviously, but it really is a bit of a non-negotiable, right?
Right.
It really is one of the ways that we can truly invest in our health and well-being, and unfortunately, one of the first things to go when we become overwhelmed and busy, and because it just is hard to maintain those connections and because loneliness is a normal human struggle.
Yes, no, that's so well put. And when we think about adult friendships, I think a lot of people think in a few different categories, mm-hmm. right? There's our childhood friends, there's our work friends, and there may be our mom friends, right? These distinct categories. But you obviously are in this world so much in terms of your research and the translation of your research to the public. So what are some unexpected ways that people can form friendships beyond maybe those discrete categories or groups?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question to think about. And I think it actually kind of raises the point that we can each develop our own categories, mm-hmm. right? That yes, there is something to be said for these boxes and how neatly some of our connections, you know, fit into those categories. I can think of the people that I've been friends with since high school or elementary school, and I can think of the new mom friends that I've made since having my son and hopefully will make with, you know, the birth of my second child soon. But some of our friendships span multiple categories.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have those boxes where there's nobody who fits in there, right? Yeah. Sometimes it is a very normal, expected, a okay experience when we don't have childhood friends, when we've made those connections later on in life. And so part of the work that I actually do a lot with clients is to reframe some of those ideas and expectations that we have about the different types of friends that we should, quote unquote, should have in our lives.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a bit of a, you know, a side piece to this question. But I think the big thing is to turn inward, right? And think about, what do I value in my life? And what are the experiences that I find meaningful? What are the causes that I'm passionate about? What are the activities that I really enjoy and find meaning in? And how can I share those with somebody? Or how would I like to share those with somebody in my life? And then using that as kind of a guidepost to building those new connections and staying connected to friends. So I'm not sure if that totally answers your question.
It does. But no, it does. And you know, for me, I kind of consider myself to be a friend collector. Like that's my collection. Most of my closest friends I've been friends with for 25, 30, 35, one almost 40 years. And, you know, they're so cherished to me. And for me, as you said, you know, they don't all fit into neat categories. And, you know, one of my closest friends falls into all of those boxes. We've kind of followed each other through the lifespan. But, you know, when I became a mom, I was a bit older, you know, than some of the other people who were pregnant at that time. So, you know, there wasn't this connection with these mom groups. You know, we were at different stages of our lives and different views on parenting, too. And so for me, I really just relied on that network that I've been fortunate to have for a very, very long time. And but you're right. I mean, they don't fit in discrete categories. And so encouraging people to think beyond that. And I like what you said about, you know, causes that you're interested in or things that you're passionate about, because you're going to find more like-minded people within those groups rather than just being like, we share this job or we share having had children is, you know, only a small element of who we are as individuals.
That's it. I mean, similarity is, I say this all the time, but similarity is often the root of friendship. It's the starting point of friendship. It's what allows us to stay connected. But that can look very different, right? And the more we can move beyond that kind of surface level similarity of, oh, well, we both have children around the same age, or we both happen to be therapists or psychologists, right?
Yeah.
Then oftentimes the closer we feel, the more we can connect and the more of our lives we can share with each other, the more trust and closeness and intimacy we experience in that relationship generally.
I love that. So The obvious impact of the pandemic on many is being isolated and being removed from those connections in person. What have you seen in terms of how adult friendships have shifted over the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really interesting to see how our friendships are changing. And I use the word our because obviously I'm going through this myself too. And so thinking a lot about friendships, experiencing these changes, working with clients in this area. It's just been really interesting and powerful and a very human right experience to have. I think the big takeaway that I want to share first is that there is no one experience.
Yeah.
That I'm hearing lots of different takeaways, oftentimes very conflicting views and experiences here. So what I mean by that is some people are reporting, unsurprisingly, that they're feeling increasingly lonely and disconnected. And I think that is absolutely important to mention because that is part of the trend that we're seeing. People are becoming lonelier. And it's understandable, right? We aren't able to see our friends as often as we'd like. There isn't that same in-person connection or that same in-person energy that so many of us are missing. We're missing out on physical touch even and closeness that's so important for our friendships. And then there's also the piece of the conflicting views and values, which I think is so huge that for many people, perhaps for the first time in that friendship or in that relationship, they've had to confront the reality that, wow, I actually don't see this situation the same way my friend does.
Mm-hmm.
And because we tend to be somewhat similar to our friends, and because that's what, again, links us initially, we expect that our friends will think like us and be like us and behave like us. And so when they don't, it's incredibly surprising. It can be very upsetting. And I mean, not to mention from a public health perspective, there can also be very real consequences to that. And so that is really playing out certainly in many, many friendships.
Yeah.
Flip side though, is that I'm also hearing there are some people who feel very connected to their friends.
Right.
That this is a time that's forced us to confront how important and non-negotiable our friendships are, how much we benefit from feeling close and connected, that kind of reevaluation process that's had to happen in our friendships has meant that some friendships have ended, but it's also meant that we've been able to really invest in and prioritize the friendships that do really matter to us.
Yeah.
And so it's not all bad. It's kind of, you know, the best way I can put it. And that there isn't one right way to feel right now, that all of those experiences are completely valid.
Aside from the ubiquitous Zoom sessions, what are some creative ways you've seen that people have connected with each other over the pandemic?
Yeah, I love this question. And every time I'm asked this, I'm forced to kind of, you know, think, self-reflect a little bit and think, well, what am I doing, right? Like, how can I be doing a better job of staying connected to the people that I care about? You know, one of the just very practical things that I've been hearing a lot about that people have really been enjoying is letter writing, actually.
Oh,
you know, it's who doesn't love receiving letters and packages, especially when we're all stuck at home, right? And that, again, when we're missing that closeness, that physical closeness, and especially when we're relying and sometimes over-relying on technology to stay connected, having something tangible that we can hold in our hand, that we know a friend touched, that's just unexpected and thoughtful, feels so good.
Yes.
And so that's just one fun thing I like to throw out there. But what has worked well for me is to develop kind of rituals and traditions, because they tend to be easier to fit into our busy days. I'm thinking of one of my close friends, and we have, you know, certain times a day where we're more likely to speak, whether it's having our morning coffee together as we're getting ready for the day or cooking dinner together. Those kinds of experiences tend to be really helpful. But I think overall, it really is worth questioning, again, what role is technology playing in my friendship right now? Because we are so lucky that we have access to Zoom, to FaceTime, to, you know, virtual ways of connecting that give us access to some nonverbal information that would be missing otherwise. Thank goodness for that. And yet we also were not made to stare at a screen all day.
Right.
And we also each differ in terms of our threshold for how exhausting and draining we find that.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we don't want to have a Zoom call. Sometimes we want to just text, and that's okay, right? But I certainly wouldn't recommend only texting a friend. So it really is about that balance and finding that newness, because I think that sense of monotony that I think we can all relate to in some way right now. That shows up in our friendships too. And we need newness in our relationships. We want that momentum and energy. And so finding ways to incorporate a bit of that is helpful.
For me, about 2 years ago, I moved to a different, a very different neighborhood in Montreal. And part of why we chose the neighborhood we did was a friend of mine lives here and was constantly saying to her, you're not going to regret it. The sense of community that's here in this neighborhood is unlike anywhere else in Montreal. And I've lived everywhere else in Montreal. And so I kind of drank the Kool-Aid and bought into it. And I mean, both my husband and I have talked about how grateful we feel to be living where we're living, because we truly live in an area that has a very strong sense of community. And that has made a tremendous difference. One of the things that happened is this small group of friends that all live in this neighborhood, we started this thing where we spontaneously, there's no schedule, there's no, you know, it's your turn or your turn. Spontaneously, you know, one of us would make or buy something, like a little treat or a little something, and just surreptitiously drop it off at the five houses, and then just text the group saying, check your front doorstep. It was so meaningful. And we had this going for months. And it was just, like you said about the newness, it was just this nice thing to know you're being thought of or that you're thinking of others.
Yeah, novelty. And I think you touched on something so important there, which is this idea of thoughtfulness, right? We want to feel like our friends are thinking of us. And we talk a lot about that and how that experience plays out in our romantic relationships and partnerships, right? How important it is to not just have quality time, but to communicate our appreciation and love for each other in very kind of overt ways. And we often don't have those same kinds of conversations about our friendships. And it turns out that those kinds of gestures are certainly no less meaningful and are frankly quite essential to keeping our friendships feeling close, especially in times when we can't connect in the ways that we're accustomed to.
That's a nice segue to the next topic I wanted to explore. We talk a lot about what qualities make a good friend when we're talking about childhood friendships. You know, we teach kids to share, to take turns, to ask your friend what they want to do, all of these kinds of things. But we don't talk about what makes a so-called good friendship in adulthood. Do the skills that we're really teaching in childhood, do they translate to good friendship skills in adulthood?
Oh, I love this question. So this actually ties back to a lot of the research that I've done in this area, because one of the things that I looked at were the different expectations that we have for our friends as young adults and as adults. Yeah. And I mean, one of the takeaways is that the expectations are actually quite similar throughout our development. So if we think, as you're saying, about what we expect from our friends when we're younger, what we teach our kids, right, and how we approach our friendships as adults, we see that themes of trust, right? I expect this person to be somebody I can share things with, and they won't share that with other people, that they're going to be reliable in some way, that they will follow through with promises made, that they'll be available when they say that they'll be available. Right. That idea of reciprocity and equality or balance that you're talking about when I think you're talking about the sharing and the collaboration.
Exactly.
That certainly is important. The exchange of different kinds of support, right? That too is there kind of throughout our lives. So I don't necessarily think that we're failing when it comes to talking about what makes for a good friend. I just think we need to keep having those conversations, right, and that we, for whatever reason, stop. That we just decide, okay, that's been enough, or that should be enough, right? And we should have it figured out. But it helps to have a reminder every now and then. Yeah. And I mean, the one thing I will say is, even though the broader categories remain similar, how that plays out and what that actually looks like can really vary. And there tends to be much more nuance in adult friendships than there is in younger children or youth friendships. And so we need to kind of adjust our skills or our behaviors accordingly, or our expectations. And for example, like the idea of intimacy and self-disclosure and vulnerability, that becomes much more crucial and central in our friendships as adults than it is perhaps when we're younger, partly because we have the capacity to self-reflect and to share a little bit more, but also because that's what we're really looking for. And that's how we're relying on each other
Yeah. And I think this notion that culturally, I think we still grapple with in romantic relationships and the implication on friendships is this notion of one person being all of the things that we need. Yeah. Yes. And so similarly in friendships, you know, I know that my friendships are unique. And so one friend might be the one who's going to kick me in the butt when I need that butt kick, and the other one who's going to be much gentler and is going to be like, I'm so sorry when I need the I'm so sorry or whatever it is. But this notion of, like you said, it's more nuanced, and being able to appreciate that that is not only okay, but important that people serve different roles.
Absolutely. Yeah, that resonates so, so deeply with me, both in terms of thinking about my own friendships and also just what we see and the kinds of conversations that often come up in my work on friendship, because there is very much, when we're younger, this expectation and also the experience that we will have, for example, a best friend or that one person who kind of we do everything with, that kind of is expected to meet all of our friendship needs at that point in time. And for many, many people, that isn't the case as we grow, nor does it need to be. That we do have, we can have, and it's very helpful to have different people who meet different needs. And so, you know, one of the biggest pieces of advice I often have is to be honest with ourselves about what our friends are capable and not capable of giving us.
Yeah.
And that can lead to more opportunities for connection and fewer opportunities for heartache or disappointment.
Yes. One of the memories I have of a friendship moment that really kind of took me off guard was there was a time in my life I was struggling with a particular issue and I really needed support around it, but wasn't necessarily ready to talk about the issue itself. And I was having coffee with a friend, and he was listening and really supportive. And I realized at some point that he didn't actually ask me what it was, what the issue was. And that was so striking and appreciated. To sit there with somebody and be completely heard and supported, knowing that that other person had no other agenda other than just to meet you where you're at and be supportive, was so positively jarring. It stuck with me. And I thought, that was incredible. Like, what a gift that you can give somebody in your friendship. I think sometimes with friendships, the intimacy that we equate with friendship means you're going to trust me with the information that you're going through. And so if you're not telling me, maybe it's because we're not intimate enough or we're not close enough. So that may be threatening to some people. But for my friend in that moment to sit there and confidently be able to not even try to pry open what the issue was, but to still be supportive was so powerful and something that you don't see a lot in how friendships are shown, how they're discussed. It was impressive.
There's so much in that I just think is so meaningful. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that we don't talk enough about what it looks like to support somebody else who is struggling, period, across the board, right? Whatever it is that we're struggling with, whoever that other person is, that I do think there's a fundamental lack of information and resources about what true support actually looks like or what it can look like. Because as you're saying, sometimes we do want somebody to just give us that reality check and say, hey, you know what, snap out of it, right?
Absolutely.
But there are also those moments where if anyone responded like that, it would be completely inappropriate and extremely hurtful. Yeah. And I think a big part of what you're talking about is this phrase that, you know, you obviously know, and I'm sure a lot of people listening have heard, this idea of holding space, right? That what true support looks like is giving somebody the opportunity to open up on their own terms. And that trust and intimacy piece doesn't just come through in terms of the words that we're sharing, but in terms of being able to feel that we are allowed to feel.
Yeah.
And whatever that is, whatever that emotion is, that it's not too big, it's not too scary. And that the presence or absence of that isn't a reflection of the other person, isn't a reflection of the closeness of our friendship.
Yes.
That is so key. And I think those are the kinds of conversations that we really aren't having often enough. And you know, part of what I really like to focus on in some of the writing and work that I do, because I think the more we can learn how we can support the people closest to us and also communicate what it is we need to feel supported, because those conversations are equally important.
Right.
Oftentimes, again, the closer we feel and the stronger the link becomes between social support from our friends and our mental health and well-being.
Right. One thing that comes to mind is something that I often coach parents to do when responding to their children, when their children bring up these issues, and before diving into problem solve, like asking, like, is this something that you want me to just listen to and help you with? Or do you want me to actually problem solve with you? Mm-hmm. And I think being able to communicate that in friendships too, to say, I'm about to tell you something, I really need your help in solving this, or I just need you to listen for a bit. So it's incumbent upon us also to communicate those needs to our friends.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. And I, you know, one of the themes that I hear a lot is this idea or expectation that our friends should just know that they should be able to read our minds, right? Which obviously, I mean, yeah, our friends have insight into who we are and what tends to be helpful, but not always, right? And it can be problem specific in terms of whatever it is that we're struggling with. Maybe this is something where we really do want that guidance, you know, on, but it can also be time specific, right? There may be moments or days where we are just not wanting to have these feelings solved or fixed or receive unsolicited advice, which I think there's rarely a good time for unsolicited advice, but there can be especially terrible times for unsolicited
advice. That's right.
And so yeah, the more we can communicate that, the better matched the exchange of support will be.
Yeah. And as we've kind of alluded to in this discussion, the challenges or problems or circumstances that come up in life are more complex through adulthood. And so the things that we're supporting a friend through may be much bigger or have much bigger consequences. So whether we're talking about loss or life changes, transitions, these things that can be incredibly heavy. And as you said, we're not talking enough about that. So what are your thoughts about how people can support friends who are going through more tumultuous or difficult life situations?
Yeah. You know, I think you touched on a few things in there that are worth revisiting. The first being, just as it's important for us to communicate what we need, it's okay to check in with our friends about what they might need in the moment. So to approach it from a place of curiosity, right? Yeah. Is this one of those times where you want help problem solving, or do you just want me to listen right now? Yeah. And that question alone, above and beyond the actual problem solving piece, right, of what happens next, that really helps our friends to feel understood. And it shows them that we're motivated and willing to support them in whatever way they need. So I actually think that's a great starting place for any kind of supported exchange. As much as possible, it does help to kind of hold back on some of that unsolicited advice sharing, right? Or some of the phrases that we're often taught are support. I see your reaction.
Yes.
You know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes. Like,
we have certain go-to sayings that we think are supportive and that we're taught are supportive, and they just really are not, right? At all. And in fact, they often backfire. So I'm talking here about what's sometimes labeled as toxic positivity, or, you know, sometimes there just aren't good labels to describe what's going on here. It just feels intrusive and unwanted and frankly, thoughtless, careless. Yeah. So things like, you know, just look on the bright side, it's not a big deal, snap out of it. Everything happens for a reason, you know. I've received that at moments in moments of my life where it really has not felt as comforting as I'm sure the other person intended it to. And that is worth mentioning. These phrases often come from a place of wanting to express care and concern for our friends. Very rarely is this an effort to just, you know, minimize our friends' distress or struggles and move on with the conversation. But they do reflect the fact that we don't talk about what actually is supportive. And so all we're left with are these go-tos or these catchphrases that feel very inauthentic and very unsupportive.
That's it.
Yeah, I think that you've hit on something that I feel is so important to reiterate. It's that obviously they're well-meaning, you know, phrases or attempts at connection that happen to be very invalidating for a lot of people. And some of it is because it's a worldview. You know, some people really do hold the worldview that everything happens for a reason. But in general, projecting our own worldviews on other people is probably not a great way to go. But also because, like you said, there's the lack of knowing what to say instead, right? So whether it's a miscarriage, whether it's an illness, whether it's loss, whether it's, you know, a divorce, whatever it might be, we don't know what to say, number one. Number two, I think a lot of it comes from our own discomfort of seeing somebody we care about hurting. So we want to try to minimize the discomfort. Again, not in any malicious way, but because we love them. We don't want them to be hurting. So if we just try to, everything will be okay, I'm sure of it, then we'll both feel better. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, often what happens is we're putting these vulnerable people in positions of now caretaking, you know, the friend, which is obviously counterproductive and problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you've expressed it beautifully there. Absolutely. You know, we also have this expectation that we need to fill silence all the time, that we need to say something. Now, you know, that there are alternatives to some of these not so supportive statements that can be very helpful, but it's also okay to not have the words. It's also okay to just sit in silence. It's also okay to say, I don't have the words here. I don't know what to say, but know that I am here and know that I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
That is often a very helpful go-to when we notice our tendency to want to fill the void, to want to fix, to want to minimize our own distress and our friends. Just owning it, labeling what's going on. I'm having trouble knowing what to say here, but I am with you and I am here for you. Yeah.
Yes. You know, that exact situation has been coming up a lot for me lately in trying to do anti-racism work and trying to do my own reflection. And I have found myself often saying outright, I don't know that I have the right words. I don't know that I am going to express how I want to express myself, but I can't let that stop me from showing up in a way that is supportive. So trying to just say, hey, I don't know if this is the right thing to say, but I'm here for you.
Yeah. And there's a difference between like quiet presence and apathy, right? And I think that our friends do pick up on that. And there are many, many ways that we can communicate our presence, our commitment to support in the absence of words. Yeah. And that's unfortunately also why I think a lot of people are feeling so disconnected right now from their friends, is because we don't, again, don't have physical touch. We don't often have that same closeness where we can convey that presence. And that is really hard.
You mentioned all the ways that we communicate. And so if we shift to thinking about communication itself, particularly metacommunication, I know you've written about metacommunication. So what is metacommunication and why is it important?
Yeah, I love this question. So metacommunication is really just a fancy word for talking about our communication, communicating about communication, right? And that can look, again, very different depending on the friendship, depending on what it is we're wanting to work through. But it again reflects this expectation that conversations and moments of connection and feeling understood should just happen organically, and that friends should just be able to know and figure this out. But having those discussions about things like, how often are we connecting? Is it enough? Are you feeling like we're talking often enough in a way that works for you? How are we connecting? Are you finding yourself experiencing Zoom fatigue, right? Can we mix this up and bring in some of that newness that we were talking about before? Talking about how you resolve arguments or conflicts together and how you like to do that. Revisiting it after an argument. What was that like for you, right? Those kinds of discussions, again, help us to problem solve and adapt and make sure that we're staying connected, but also inherently express that desire to stay connected and that level of thoughtfulness and care that we're really looking for in our friendships.
What is striking to me is that if we spoke more about the importance of metacommunication in all of our relationships, how widespread the positive impact would be, right? Like in our romantic relationships, if it was normalized that we don't just expect our partners to divine things about us and vice versa. But if it was just so normalized that that is how you make relationships work, parent-child, friend-friend, romantic, whatever, work relationships, that if you just spoke about, hey, you know, I'm checking in, how am I meeting your needs? And here's what I'm experiencing. If that was normalized across the board, the ripple effect would be tremendous.
Yeah, this isn't specific to friendships by any means, right? The idea of metacommunication, the importance of talking about how we're connecting, I agree with you, is there across the board for all of our different connections and relationships. And the benefits certainly would be there across the board. I think to some extent that is emphasized a little bit more in our romantic partnerships, yeah. Even though we all struggle with this too, for very good reasons, right? That we talk about the importance of open communication and honesty, and that discourse is there, and it's certainly not there for our friendships.
Right.
And there's often a lot of apprehension and anxiety about bringing this to the table, again, in our relationships, but especially in our friendships, because it isn't normalized in the way that I really feel it needs to be.
Right.
And it is vulnerable, right? It's a type of self-disclosure. And it's vulnerable to share and it's vulnerable to ask. Yeah. But the more we can do it, often the closer we feel and the more connected we feel. So
that's it.
It is worth thinking about and maybe trying to push back a little bit against, you know, some of that.
Exactly. So as a therapist now, what are some of the ways that you help your clients improve their relationships or strengthen or form new friendships?
Yeah. So there's so many different ways to answer this question. And, you know, when people are coming to therapy, if we focus here specifically on friendships right now, for a friendship related challenge, it can look very different in terms of why they're seeking support and in terms of what therapy ends up looking like and the direction that we take. I often divide it into two pieces, the interpersonal and the personal, because the interpersonal piece is all about the relationship dynamic piece, right? In terms of whether that's making friends. Okay, where do I make friends? And how do I connect with these people, right? It's very skills-based often. How do I build that connection and that closeness? How do I maintain my friendship? Kind of a lot of what we're talking about here today, even an ending of friendship, right? What are the different ways that we can do that? And what options are you weighing? And really working to explore the different ways that those types of situations can play out. Yeah. So those are some of the conversations we have, but then there's also the personal piece, which ends up being equally important and sometimes more so even, right? Mm-hmm. And that's working through some of the barriers that we have, some of the resistance that we have, some of the beliefs and expectations and anxieties that we have about our connections. So again, that can look a little bit like working through some anxious thoughts that are there, some social anxiety, right? It can look like working through some of the beliefs we have about our inherent worth and how that then keeps us stuck in relationships that have long run their course that we might really benefit from letting go of, how that keeps us from building new connections and taking up space in our relationships. So it's a pretty loaded question because it can look very different, but it ends up being really rich, the kinds of conversations that we have, just because there is so much that goes into connection.
Yeah.
The root of connecting with others is being able to connect with ourselves and knowing who we are and what it is we want and what it is we deserve.
And have you had occasion to see friends together in session? And if so, tell me about that.
Yeah. So this is something that I'm really excited about doing more of. This is super new. I should say that, you know, this whole idea, firstly, that we would even be talking about our friendships period in therapy is a little bit new, because again, people think other relationships are sometimes more important or more complicated or, you know, more deserving of taking up space in our lives. So even working one-on-one with clients in the context of friendship therapy is new.
Yeah,
I am seeing more and more this trend of people being open and willing to work through friendship challenges together. And this is definitely something I've seen over the last decade or so, you know, since I've been doing work in this space, both clinically, but also just in terms of my writing and media work, that those discussions are being had more and more. And there was a book that came out not too long ago called Big Friendship. The authors had interviewed me for this, and they talk about their experience in friendship therapy. And I actually think that book has had a huge impact on helping to normalize the idea that we could seek therapy as friends. So that's a really positive benefit. I'm getting more and more requests. I mean, as you know, the licensing regulations make it a little bit complicated because this is so new, like the baseline interest is, you know, it is lower. People don't know that this is an option. And so I'm having to turn down a lot of requests actually, just because I'm not able to offer therapy to people living outside of Quebec.
Right.
But I do see that that's a theme that, or like a trend that's coming up more and more. Yeah. And certainly something that I'm passionate about exploring further in my own work and offering resources in that area, because there isn't much out there, frankly.
It's an exciting direction. And I have had situations in which someone that I'm working with one-on-one, we have brought in a friend on occasion. And that has been so rich and valuable, because oftentimes just hearing how my client is perceived by their friends, it provides a whole new lens and avenue to work. But being able to facilitate those conversations between them to say, okay, so how can we improve the friendship to support each other? And in, you know, my case, how my client specifically.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. And I appreciate you sharing that, because I think there are different reasons why we might seek, you know, support with a friend. Certainly what comes to mind first for a lot of people is working through a conflict or a challenge, but that's not always the case. Just like right. It's not always the case for couples therapy, right? It's not always the case that we seek help in that moment where, you know, we are suffering terribly and really having trouble connecting. Sometimes it's very much about wanting to improve on what is working, right? Yes. And another theme that I'm hearing a lot, and that truthfully, this ends up coming up quite often in the context of workshops that I do, less so in therapy, but is this whole idea of co-working relationships, because we're seeing how connected our friendships are with our success, right? I think understandably, a lot of people are entering into partnerships with their friends and wanting to work together, to build something, to create something, to share something. And that's beautiful and meaningful and can be really helpful, but there are also then other pieces that need to be navigated and other discussions that really need to be had. And so I see in that space too, people are increasingly willing to have a therapist, have a coach, so to speak, to be able to support them in building that relationship and finding the balance between the personal and professional.
Everything that you've shared, I think, is so valuable and needs to be shared more. So I'm grateful that you're sharing your wisdom with us today. You've mentioned, you know, you write, you have a lot of media contribution. What are some ways that people can learn more about the great work that you're doing?
Thank you. Yeah. So, I mean, I have my website, which is my name, miriamkermeyer.com. And there you can find links to some of the articles that I've written or interviews that I've done or podcast episodes, right? Just so that you can hear a little bit more guidance in this area if you're looking for that. I also am on social media. I would say I'm most present on Instagram. That's where I do a lot of kind of community building and we do a lot of polls and Q&As, helping to normalize some of these discussions and experiences. And I share a lot of takeaways there. And I have a newsletter community that I also invite people to sign up for. And that's the best way to stay up to date on any upcoming workshops or courses or offerings. And my book that I'm writing on, I'll be sharing a little bit more information there too.
Yes, I look forward to hearing more about that. And your work is filling a void, like we talked about, and it's so needed. And I definitely would encourage people to check out your Instagram. I love the polls that you put out and just seeing the results, so people feel the connection with others going through similar experiences. And, you know, the honesty and vulnerability that shows up in your account is so appreciated, and you're doing such great work. So thank you for sharing that.
The feeling is so mutual.
I want to end with the question that I ask all of my guests, which is, what is some of the best advice you've received from a supervisor or colleague?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll give two answers here. Two things come to mind that I think were stand out to me. The first is, in some ways, I've had a bit of an non-conventional path to get here because I started a lot of this work early on in graduate school.
Yeah.
When frankly, it was pretty actively discouraged by some people. and it was really helpful in those moments to have those mentors that I could turn to who were very supportive of the goals that I had and of the values that I held close that perhaps weren't shared by other people. And so really receiving the advice and guidance that you're allowed to carve out your own path and you're allowed to pursue what you find meaningful and that that doesn't have to match up with what other people are doing or expecting of you and that that's okay. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. That just means it's different and different can be great, interesting, and meaningful. Yeah. So that's one thing that I just really feel that I've benefited from that I, looking back, especially now, I'm so appreciative of. The other piece I'll tie back to community, just because I think that's what we were talking about. And I feel really strongly that from a clinical perspective, in terms of building a private practice and a reputation, being able to make connections with other therapists and psychologists, to receive that mentorship and exchange that mentorship, that putting that into place earlier on and being really intentional with maintaining connections with people that I trust and admire, that that has been really helpful. And you are absolutely included in that circle. But that's something that I would really encourage anyone who's in this field, for example, to do, that it's never too early to start making those connections and that they are really incredibly valuable for so many reasons, because, you know, especially now that we're all working behind a computer screen, it can also feel a bit lonely being a therapist as well. And so I'm just really grateful for those connections.
Exactly. Well, you're doing great modeling for other clinicians who are carving out their own paths and seeing a different possibility and playing to all of your many strengths. And you do it all with such grace and wisdom. So thank you for all that you do. And thank you for sharing that with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now, lessons from the couch. For today's lessons from the couch, I want to highlight what Miriam said about metacommunication, communicating about communicating, particularly with your friends. I'm going to challenge myself and I'm going to challenge all of you to talk to at least one friend about how your communication has been over the pandemic and see if there's anything that needs to change for you or for them to support each other better as we go forward. I think our time is done for today, but I look forward to continuing this conversation next time.